From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Did you ever own a chip and dip? Today in the show, we're going back in time to Madison Avenue, circa 1960, to explore the food and the drink of Mad Men. Tips on how to select the best honey, breaking the rules with your next cheese plate. Plus, Jonathan Gold takes us to a pop-up restaurant in downtown L.A. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this first week of 2012 at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Happy New Year from the Santa Monica Farmers Market. This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's the first week of January. We're happy to be back at the market on a beautiful, unseasonably warm day here in Southern California, visiting with David Lefevre, who is the chef and owner of the recently opened MB Post restaurant in Manhattan Beach. It's been open since April 2011, and David has just started featuring brunch. And this is one of these laid-back, beachside, fabulous former Actually, it's a former post office. David, you've just been tearing it up down there. Brunch is now starting. Tell us what you're featuring and give us a sense of what's going on at the restaurant.
Yeah, we started brunch this week and really seasonal produce from the market. The vibe is really a neighborhood vibe. People that are out walking on the beach, starting their Sundays and Saturdays off with a good cup of coffee, maybe a nice cocktail if it's not too early in the morning. But we really wanted an opportunity to do a smaller menu, but using whatever is available, whether right now it's citrus and pears and apples and quince or tropical fruit, just trying not to take ourselves too seriously, have a lot of fun, and create just a place for people in Manhattan Beach and all around to come into and just enjoy a real sunny, nice morning brunch.
Yeah. And now tell us some of the things you're going to be featuring at the brunch.
Well, we're going to be doing our bacon cheddar biscuits, which we've developed some strange cult following for.
So those
are on the menu. We're also using those biscuits to do an eggs benedict with arugula and liqueur prosciutto and a nice hollandaise. So they'll be on that. We're doing a in-house ricotta and quince preserved stuffed French toast with chestnut honey. We're doing a Meyer lemon and blueberry griddle corn cake, which is really yummy, with tonic one noble syrup. And that's great because that's something that I'm finding here at the market every Wednesday and Saturday is right now citrus is just booming, you know, whether it's clementines or tangerine, Meyer lemon. Meyer lemon is so great because it's got that great lemony aroma and it's got a slightly sweeter taste. It's not as acidic, so it's great for making preserves or making confit lemon.
So we can only get those at brunch.
Can only get those at brunch, yeah. Yeah, exactly. But the market here is booming. I mean, today, coming back after New Year's and everybody having a crazy week, and it's beautiful here. I mean, the weather's awesome. Everybody seems to be in a great mood, and the product that's coming out is amazing. You're walking by stands. You can smell the passion fruit, the guava, and you can citrus everywhere. And then you go to the other ones. You've got apples, and it's a really great time. People forget how great winter is, especially here in Southern California for the market. I mean, everybody's, you know, gung-ho about summers with strawberries and berries and stuff, but, I mean, winter fruit and citrus is amazing down here.
Okay, well, David, we're so glad you're here. You're going to be 1 year old in April, and the brunch is happening, and the recipes sound amazing. So thanks so much.
Thank you. Cheers.
That was David Lefevre, and he's the chef owner of MB Post, Manhattan Beach Post. It's a former post office. Very local scene down there in Manhattan Beach with local influences and, of course, California flavors. Speaking of citrus, as David was talking about waxing prolific, about all the wonderful citrus we have, one of our most interesting citrus growers at the market is Mud Creek Ranch, which is an organic farm from Santa Paula. And daughter Margarita Smith is here today. I walked by your stand, as I do. I tasted a random tangerine. This one's called an Ellendale. I'd never heard of it, never seen it. It is delicious. Then I checked with David Karp. He says you are one of the only two people in California that even have these trees.
Yes.
So can you tell us about the Ellendale and tell us a little more about your whole tangerine program?
Okay, so the Ellendale tangerine is one of those varieties that we have a connection with the UC Riverside Extension when they make new hybrids of tangerines. And that variety was developed, I think, maybe 3 years ago. And we're one out of five farmers usually that get to try new varieties that they develop, but only this time they had limited supplies. And we have 5 trees out of maybe 7 that exist right now.
In the whole state of California, you have 5 and somebody else has 2.
Yeah, in the whole state of California.
And you must have planted them several years ago because now they're producing?
Yeah, we planted them about 2.5 years ago.
It's a big tangerine. It looks kind of lumpy. It's kind of, it doesn't look beautiful, but boy, are they good.
The Ellendale is, it's like the whole Tahoe Gold family. Like, it was a hybrid with an orange, so it's just bigger and juicier and has less acid compared to, like, a Satsuma or something like that. It's like having, like, a orange popsicle because it's made from concentrate. It's just a really sweet flavor.
Exactly. And now tell us how many varieties, this always blows my mind, how many varieties of tangerines do you grow altogether?
Of tangerines, I think we grow about 75 varieties.
Now, if the Ellendale catches on, and I know people don't like seeds, but suppose the Ellendale does catch on, would you be able to plant some more?
Most definitely. Yeah, the reason why we haven't done it yet is because we need to either UC Riverside creates more rootstock of it, or we can start grafting, but we don't really have enough space right now to do that. We got to take out some old trees to plant new ones, so...
Yeah, and I think you guys are doing a good job of holding down that little piece of property and then growing these things. I mean, the Ellendale alone is just such a great find for me and customers as well. It's so amazing.
Yeah, I love doing this. I've been doing this, like, before I was born. My family started this farm, so it's always been a part of my life, and it's super fun to try new varieties. There's stuff we grow that I don't even know we grow till I see it. The other day I had the first Oro Blanco of the season, and it just, every year, the anticipation, like, trying the new stuff is really exciting, so.
Margarita, well, thank you so much. I got to go back and grab some more of those Ellendales, but they will be around for about another month.
Yes, they will. Yeah.
Okay, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Margarita Smith. She's the daughter of the Smith Ranch farming family up in Santa Paula. They're a certified organic ranch. Not only do they grow 75 varieties of tangerines, but the whole rest of their citrus, apple, fruit production is amazing. So do stop by when you're at the Wednesday Santa Monica Market and check them out. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for David Lefevre's griddle cakes with Meyer lemon and blueberry, yum, is on the Good Food blog. Just before the new year, I made the announcement that after 27 years, I will close my restaurant, Angeli Cafe. This decision has to rank as the most difficult one of my life. Last week, KCRW's Lisa Napoli, host of All Things Considered, asked me to come into the KCRW studio, sit on the other side of the table, and discuss my decision. The following excerpt comes from our conversation.
So what was the beginning like? Let's go back to that.
Well, I mean, it was such a different time all over the country, but particularly LA, because during the late 70s, early 80s, there was no middle when it came to cuisine in Los Angeles. Mm. There was the beginning of the very high end, and there were a certain number of dining palaces that had survived the 50s, early 60s that were still around. And there were always ethnic dives. But this whole idea of bistro dining where you could go out and get something really good to eat that was pretty simple, didn't cost a lot, and maybe there was some sense of style, that pretty much did not exist when I opened Angeli in 84. So I opened this when I first opened, it was just 1,000 square feet. We had 24 seats. And I was really scared to open with a whole menu because we had a staff that knew nothing, and including myself. And so all we were selling was pizza, panini, and salads. We didn't add, other hot foods for another month or so. And people were waiting in line for 2 hours for these panini, and I realized that I had touched a nerve, which was just this idea of combining a kind of stylish place, which was a shout out to Tom Main and Michael Rotundi of the Morphosis of that period. He built this tiny little place for me, and it was just simple food, cheap, serving boomers who were young.
And reliable, which is so un, un, unfathomable to how you keep up that consistency.
Yeah, the consistency. Well, it hasn't been hard considering that the core group of kitchen people who work for me still work for me. So it's 27 years of the same people making pizza and cooking pasta.
How did you arrive at this decision? Can you explain how you came to today?
I was an Italian major in college, and during the course of my college years, spent every summer in Italy. I had started traveling to Europe when I was quite young. I was 16. I graduated high school early and took that gap year. Mm-hmm. And it was a time in Italy that was almost pre-industrial. It was still very, very much a country linked to the land. And everywhere I went, I stayed in a room somewhere. So I was always with a family. I was a very shy kid. So even when I was 17, 18, 19, 20, rather than go out to clubs, I just wanted to stay in the kitchen and cook with the mom and grandma. And I think that also came from the fact that I grew up as an only child, a single parent, a mom who worked all the time. I grew up in Silver Lake, and I didn't have any living grandparents. And I think that when I went to Italy, I fell in love with the type of nurturing that the kitchen, the whole culinary tradition there provided. And I think unconsciously I set out to create that in L.A.
And you created it, and you created the family to go with it.
Exactly. And it's funny because when we first opened, we were ragingly hip. I mean, it was the 80s. It was big hair, big mohawks. But we were lucky because it mutated as the boomers, as my generation got older. It morphed into this sort of modern, egalitarian family restaurant and became, in a way, L.A.'s just sort of trattoria, which must have been somewhere in the back of my mind the whole time.
Tell me about the decision to close. Why now?
I've been through two boom and bust cycles in the general economy, and I've been through the downsizing, the outsourcing, and the diminishing of the entertainment industry, which has had a huge impact on small, individually run businesses of all kinds in the Hollywood area. And so over time, I've just seen our sales diminish. And then I would think, oh, I have to close. And then they would bump up again and diminish. It's just gotten to a point where it's too hard. I have too much debt. And I really don't have any choice. I would never have done this if there were a choice. So many of my decisions for the business have been made out of emotion. And I think the last core group of decisions I made was after 2008. It was just get through the worst of this so I don't release my employees into what it looked like 4 years ago. And that's the part for me that's the hardest right now.
The people.
The people.
Yeah.
You know, if there's any chefs out there listening, I have people who have worked for 27 years, never had a drink, never shown up drunk, never been late. It's remarkable.
It's quite an achievement.
And the front of the house staff, too. I mean, Angeli is this sort of psychological gestalt almost. It's something that's created in such a communal way between the staff and the customers because we've known such a huge percentage of them for so many years. You know, we've watched people have their first dates, court, get married, get pregnant, have kids. The kids go to elementary school, junior high, high school, college. It's pretty incredible.
Evan, thank you so much for coming in and talking. I know it's a crazy time, an emotional time, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lisa. I have to say that I could never have imagined the outpouring of genuine love and affection now coming my way. I want to thank everyone on behalf of the staff of Angeli and myself for all the years that we've had together. I look forward to sharing the next chapter with you, so stay tuned. If you want to be on my new newsletter email list, please go now to angelicafe.com. That, of course, is spelled with two F's. And subscribe. The new evankleiman.com website will be live in about a month. Stay tuned.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Anyone who has fallen under the spell of the Emmy Award-winning AMC show Mad Men, and I am one, I have to say, has likely felt the urge to light a cigarette and sip an old-fashioned while watching the show, or maybe even make a reservation at a long-lost, fabulous New York restaurant. Judy Gelman and Peter Zeitlin fell so deeply under that spell that they decided to delve into the food and drink of the 1960s Mad Men lifestyle with their recent book, The Unofficial Mad Men Cookbook, Inside the Kitchens, Bars, and Restaurants of Mad Men. They join me today to discuss the making of this fascinating culinary time warp.
We looked very carefully at every food that was seen, tasted, mentioned, that we could observe on the shelf of a refrigerator, for example. We really tried to make a chronicle of everything we could find food-related in Mad Men.
The thing that kind of interests me is the bifurcation, of course, of family life out in the suburbs and the food that's consumed around the advertising characters, either in the office or out at bars and restaurants. Did you focus at all on the suburban food, or was it mostly on the cachet of the restaurants?
Oh, we really wanted to do both. We thought both were equally as important, and you know, and exactly what you're referring to. Both of these places, the suburbs and the city, where they're dining out at elegant restaurants, really, you know, tell something about the characters and the time period.
Let's first start in the home, which I find really fascinating because it seems like Don is incapable of actually sitting down and joining in for dinner. He seems to eat out a lot of the refrigerator, and he's eating a lot of cold food like chicken salads and things of that nature.
You're absolutely right. Don is usually seen, you know, having his drink in the office. He's at a business lunch or cocktails with people from the agency or one of his, you know, love interests, or he's eating the cold chicken salad or Swedish meatballs that Betty's kept waiting for him.
But what is she making for the kids?
She's making, you know, what housewives made for their families at that time. And you have to remember, Betty doesn't really like to cook. That's pretty clear early on in the show. As a matter of fact, one of the casseroles she prepares for the family is turkey tetrazzini, and we matched that with a recipe from Peg Bracken's I Hate to Cookbook. And then we also have the dinner parties they throw in their homes, where Betty is experimenting with some of the more interesting international foods at the time.
Right. There was that fabulous international dinner where they used her as an experiment in marketing Heineken.
Right. It's called Betty's Around the World Dinner, and you may remember she introduces each food. She takes people basically on a world tour through the food that she's serving that night, which in large part reflects a mid-century interest in international cuisine that was really exploding in the late 50s, early 60s. A lot of it inspired, of course, by Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, which was published in 1961.
We're going to take a little trip around the world, starting in Spain with gazpacho, followed by Japan, rumaki, and then we'll stop by Dutchess County for a leg of lamb, mint jelly, accompanied by egg noodles, the way my grandmother made them from Germany. And we have a choice of Burgundy from France or a frosted glass of beer from Holland.
Ooh. So let's sort of shift now from the suburbs to the city, where you have these evenings out in restaurants in which wives are used as trophy and bait simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you know, wives were there to accompany their husbands often to business meetings, to charm the guests, to charm potential clients. We went back to a lot of the restaurants that are depicted in Mad Men, some of which are still alive and well, such as Sardi's and Keene's Steakhouse, some of which are long gone, such as Lutece and the Stork Club. But we went back to their cookbooks and, in some cases, directly to their kitchens to seek recipes of foods that were ordered in Mad Men and which they served back then, or in some cases, which they still serve today unchanged.
I mean, there was also that trip to L.A. in which they stayed at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Mm-hmm. There's a scene where young advertising executive Pete Campbell is seen sitting at a pool at that hotel drinking a concoction that we couldn't We couldn't tell what it was. And it was yellow in color. It was some kind of cocktail. We asked the Beverly Hills Hotel if they could go back and help us figure out what it was. And it turns out it was a cocktail they haven't made in decades called the Royal Hawaiian, which reflected American interest in Polynesian cuisine that accompanied Hawaii's entry into the Union in 1959.
Yeah, which is so interesting because we're so far away from that time. When we think about places like Trader Vic's or these kinds of cocktails with umbrellas, we really don't have a frame of reference for them, but there was sort of a Hawaii mania then.
Yeah, and it was the hula hoop, it was Don Ho, it was the ukulele, it was Elvis Presley movies shot in Hawaii, backyard luaus, which were very popular. You know, in 1960 and the years around that, as Hawaii was preparing to enter the Union, and then shortly thereafter, people just gobbled up everything related to Hawaii, and tourism to the islands surged, and that's reflected in the popularity of restaurants like Trader Vic's, Benihana, for example.
Also, I remember when they were in a room, the creatives with Peggy Olson, and they're trying to figure out, they have that weekend where they're trying to figure out what to do with Bacardi.
Right.
And she goes and gets the blender.
Right. Paul, one of her colleagues, suggests they get a blender and turn it into a frap. And we actually found a Bacardi advertisement from the period with a recipe for a Bacardi rum frap.
I'm curious also about the food from one of the clients, Utz, the popular potato chip. Oh, why was it such a popular chip during that time?
Well, they're still popular. I don't think they sell them on the West Coast. They're still popular here on the East Coast. They're made in Pennsylvania. I actually was buying Utz potato chips long before we ever wrote this book. There's just a snap to the chip. It's something tactile about it that I really like, and my kids happen to love Utz potato chips as well.
But it's a really sturdy chip, so it could...
Very sturdy.
And
perfect
there was
for a dip.
Yeah, there was a lot of dipping going on then.
There was certainly a lot of dipping going on. We looked at a lot of dips for this book. And the California dip had to be in there, of course, because it's an integral part of that of Pete Campbell's story with his chip and dip bowl.
It's in the box. It's a wedding present. We got two.
But what is it?
It's a chip and dip.
Let me see.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I might have to go to somebody else's wedding. I like to know what people are returning.
What?
I don't know what to say. You got two of these? What is it?
You have your fingers in your ears? It's a chip and dip. You have your friends over, you put chips on the sides and dip in the middle.
Dip?
Yes. We went to these people's house and they had one. It had sour cream with these little brown onions in it. It was very good.
You'll have to give me that recipe sometime.
One of the things that fascinates me, too, is the idea of people attending the restaurants like Lutèce who haven't yet acquired a comfortable sophistication to either know about the food really or appreciate where it was from. Could you just sort of muse on what some of your thoughts were as you were doing research on some of the higher end restaurants?
Yeah, I mean, we were really surprised to learn, a little bit about the French influence, which, of course, Julia Child popularized it. But there were many French restaurants in New York at the time. And a lot of these, names of restaurants, Lutèce, La Grenouille, are dropped in Mad Men or they're seen dining there. And, it was really haute cuisine, but it was new to Americans. And, a lot of these, scenes, sort of show their ignorance about the foods, but it was fashionable to dine at these institutions and establishments. So,
if you were to put together like the sort of absolutely classic lunch out with clients at a New York restaurant, give me an idea of what would be on the table. Maybe you'll take license and put things on the table that are from different restaurants.
Well, to begin, oddly enough, it's some of the, you know, the business lunches we see on Mad Men. The men are ordering salads, which I think would surprise a lot of people. But a few of our favorite lunch scenes involve a Caesar salad at Keen's Steakhouse, which was then Keen's Chop House, which at that time was served with tableside preparation. And then another salad recipe, which is just as popular today, is the wedge with blue cheese, which Roger orders out at the Palm. So we have, two salads that are just as popular, happen to be, I think still kind of fixtures on the business lunch scene.
I just have to say, it's a treat, this book. It's it is like going back to our parents' time and our own childhood with a very different eye in terms of where we are in the culinary world today. And I have to say that a lot of the dishes are extremely appealing.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Judy Gelman and Peter Zeitlin are authors of the unofficial Mad Men cookbook, Inside the Kitchens, Bars, and Restaurants of Mad Men. A recipe from the books on the Good Food blog. What dishes from the 1960s do you think deserve a comeback? Join the conversation on my Facebook page, search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Time now for a visit from Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here every week with a restaurant suggestion. Today, we're headed to a pop-up restaurant in downtown LA.
We are going to Le Comptoir at Tiara Cafe.
Le Comptoir at Tiara Cafe. Now, Tiara Cafe, if I am not mistaken, is Fred Erick's place.
It is. It's Fred Erick's wonderful breakfast lunch place in the Fashion District downtown that's decorated like something out of Dr. Seuss's head.
Is Le Comptoir a pop-up residing inside?
It runs 3 or 4 nights a week. It's small. It's only at the counter. So there's, 8, 10, 12, maybe 16 seats. And it changes every week depending on what he's picked up at the market. I should mention that the chef here is Gary Menace, who was, the opening chef at Palette. He was a chef at Pally House for a while. He had a long pop-up at Olive and Thyme in the Valley. And probably the restaurant that most of us know him for and love him the most for is Marché in Sherman Oaks, which was one of the best restaurants ever in the Valley, I think.
How fun. So it is French. What style of French?
It's produce-driven, or farm-to-table, or what the guys in New York like to call haute barnyard, though please kill me if I ever say that. But it very much depends on what he's found at the market. I mean, it's the menu swings wildly from week to week, except for one dish.
What is that one dish?
The one dish which you'd have to say is the center of everything, is a fried egg. It's very much a version of the fried egg that René Redzepi makes at Noma in Copenhagen. I mean, the one at Noma is sort of like the summation of everything that is good about that particular season in that particular part of the world put in front of you, and you cook it yourself. So it's like you are cooking the best fried egg in the world to the best restaurant in the world with all the resources of the best restaurant in the world around you. What Menace is doing is pretty close to the same thing. So he heats up this cocotte, this metal platter, and they plop the egg on it there. You don't have to, crack it and do all the – and they walk around and they put it in front of you at the counter, and it's still violently sputtering. It's very hot. You're given a little bit of butter, and you're given, a selection of, small, beautiful greens that you sauté while the egg is cooking. And so when the egg is finished, your greens are finished, and you have this fried egg with these just beautiful greens alongside them.
That sounds so good. Sounds so good. I hope there's some really good bread to smear everything up with.
He's kind of bread obsessed. I mean, he will talk for as long as you will let him talk about the starter that he's had going for 20 years or something. And during the course of the dinner, he keeps putting in and taking out these gigantic, like totally profoundly coal black loaves of country bread that he keeps putting in the oven and taking out of the oven and putting in the oven and taking out. But he makes his own bread, and it's a huge priority for him, I think. And his house style is to undercook the bread a little bit more than one might be used to. So that there's – it's not quite as moist as custardy, but it's like still a little bit wet in the center. And since it's very – it's consistent, you know, all the times I've been there, I've got to assume that that's what he's doing. That's his aesthetic, as opposed to he's just cooking the bread like that accidentally.
Impatient.
Yeah.
So what else is – what else have you tasted that has – that's of a more serendipitous nature?
There was a beautiful, like a velouté, a very smooth soup one time with out of this gigantic banana squash. There was a beautiful chicken. This is a Nordic thing too, but he poaches it in whey.
Wow.
And probably sous vide, though I didn't ask. And so the chicken has this beautiful, soft, you know, almost like luxurious texture to it. And then the skin, he separately sears off. So you have this like wafer of crunchy skin on top of this like impossibly, you know, soft chicken. And it's a really beautiful dish.
Wow. Does the whey impart like a kind of tartness to the chicken?
It does. And I'm not sure where he gets the whey, but he does make his own cheese, so that would be a good guess. It's a soft cheese, and probably he'll shave a truffle on it for $12 if you want him to. It's a nice touch. Chefs generally don't make their own cheese. And because it's so small, while you're sitting there eating, there's four people. I mean, this is a it's almost a regular restaurant staff for a very small customer base. So they might be, you know, flitting around experimenting with stuff while you're eating.
Is it a very expensive meal to indulge in?
It isn't. It's $46 prefix.
Oh, that's
for
very good.
Five courses. And there's a wine pairing that is probably mandatory because it's nice and it's inexpensive. It's only $24, which works out to $6 a glass or something. That's cheap.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly about Le Comptoir, a pop-up restaurant housed in Tiara Cafe on 9th Street in downtown LA. The pop-up will continue to operate until the end of January. You can get the exact address and recommended dishes by just texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which you can access at Google and on our Good Food blog.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food here on KCRW. Recently, honey made big headlines with the news that a lot of the honey on supermarket shelves is commonly adulterated with sugar water, corn syrup, or other additives. Marina Marchese is a honey sommelier and beekeeper in Connecticut. She's going to share the good and delicious, as well as the not-so-delicious, in honey purchasing. Hi, Marina.
Hi.
How can we check if our honey is pure?
Well, there's a few things that you can do as just a regular consumer. When you purchased your honey, one of the things that you want to take a look at is the clarity of the honey itself. Usually, very clear honey has been super filtered. Since honey is an agricultural product, you're going to find that the color and the actual clarity of the honey should contain some pollen, which makes it foggy. The other thing that you can do is learn about tasting honey by tasting real beekeeper's honey opposed to commercially made honey. But scientifically, there's other things that can be done, like actually testing the water content and testing through a microscope the pollen. And, you know, honey that never crystallizes could also be a sign.
Now, what makes honey crystallize?
Honey's actually a composition of sugars and water. And what happens is the glucose, it's mainly glucose and fructose. So when the glucose evaporates and the water, it can crystallize more. The fructose becomes a higher content and then will crystallize naturally.
So all honey eventually crystallizes.
That's not true. Actually, there are some honeys that have a very, very high glucose content, and this is all determined by the type of flower. For example, you may have heard of Tupelo honey from Georgia. This particular honey has a very high glucose compared to the fructose content, and Tupelo is known never to really crystallize. But on the whole, most honeys will crystallize.
And because there's going to be a listener that does have a microscope at home, why don't you tell us what we can see in a microscope that tells us whether or not the honey is pure?
Well, if you look at pure honey, you'll see that there's traces of pollen actually floating in the honey. And if you know anything about pollen, you can determine by the shape and the color of the pollen the different flowers. And this gets really into the scientific study of pollen. So if you're familiar with that, or if you can get, you know, a guide, you can look it up, you can look through the microscope, and you can identify the pollen. And by identifying the pollen, you could typically identify what region that honey is from by the floral source, the plant source.
That's pretty incredible. Now, you mentioned imported honey when we were talking about large supermarket honeys. Where does most supermarket honey come from?
Well, the demand for honey in the United States is huge, and it's much more than we can actually produce. So some of the larger packers are importing honey mainly from places like China, Mexico, India, and a variety of other places like maybe Canada. And since honey is an agricultural product like cheeses and breads and, you know, other kinds of things, it has to be pasteurized. It is meant, you know, the government dictates that these foods have to be pasteurized. So these honeys that are being imported and put on the grocery store shelves are usually pasteurized or heated, overheated, and ultra-filtered so that there is no pollen in it. And it's very difficult for people to know where this honey is from because there's no pollen to trace it back to the floral source. So when you're getting grocery store honey, it should say on the back of the label the country of origin, but now I'm seeing much more times when there is no country of origin on honey and a lot of other foods too. So it's a little bit scary out there not to really know where your honey or your food is coming from.
Okay, let's talk about flavor now. You have a series of tastings in which you teach people how to taste honey very much in the same way that they've learned to taste wine or olive oil. If I was going to do a honey tasting at home with a group of friends, where should I begin?
Choose about 7 different honeys from different floral sources or from different regions. So what I like to do is have people taste each honey, and then we talk about what we're tasting. We talk about the color, the flavor profile. We like to talk about the floral source, the seasonality of it, and usually where it's from, what part of the country or what part of the world this honey is produced. So all of these things that we talk about are very similar, like as if you were doing a wine tasting or an olive oil tasting.
What about seasonality? We're so focused on seasonality now with produce, but is honey also a seasonal product?
Absolutely. This is, like, you know, really important because certain plants bloom at certain times of the year, and more importantly, they secrete the nectar for the bees to make honey at certain parts of the day. So the honeybees go out and gather the nectar from different flowers when they're blooming. So I was trying to mention that blueberry, you know, is blooming in June, And although we have the honey, you know, harvest in June, the fruits are harvested in July. But then, you know, you have an apple blossom, which is a very early spring honey. Or we have a goldenrod honey, which is very late fall. So it really depends on the plants and when they bloom. So seasonality absolutely applies to honey.
Is there such a thing as organic honey in the United States?
Not so much, because honeybees will go about 4 to 5 miles to gather the nectar that they need to make honey. So, you know, you could manage your bees and your property organically, but you don't have a control over where the bees are going. So, you know, if you're, you know, on a farm and there's a golf course a few miles away, you know that they may be spraying the grasses there, and then you have to worry about the drift and the wind. That pollen or those chemicals can be drifting into an area where your bees are foraging. So you really don't have a control over that.
Thank you so much, Marina.
Well, thank you, Evan.
Marina Marchese owns Red Bee Honey Company. Her book is Honeybee, Lessons from an Accidental Beekeeper. More and more, I see honey as an accompaniment to cheese, not only in restaurants, but at home too. The cheese plate has definitely become a fixture in our American dinner party. And with new producers popping up both locally and abroad, the selection of good cheese has expanded exponentially over the past 10 years. I asked Sarah Kate Gillingham Ryan, founder of Apartment Therapies, TheKitchen.com, to give us a lesson on how to select the perfect combination of cheeses next time we're at the cheese counter.
Well, there's a bunch of, quote, rules for this, which means you should break them all. My basic rule is to just go for what looks good. And I'm lucky enough in New York City to live near one of the best cheese counters maybe in the country, which is Murray's Cheese. And that is a really well-stocked cheese counter. And the cheesemongers who work there are not only friendly and approachable, but they are really, really knowledgeable. And so honestly, even though over the years I've learned a bit about cheese, I almost always just go in there and talk to them because they may have something in that's new that they just tasted or that just won an award or that they're trying out for a local cheesemaker. And so if you have a cheesemonger like that, I would say the best thing to do is to just ask questions and talk to them. But that said, yeah, there are some approaches. One is to do, you know, one of each type of cheese. In other words, a soft cheese, a hard cheese, a semi-soft cheese, or an aged cheese, or a washed rind cheese, to sort of go with each of these types of cheeses, a blue cheese. Another is to be, you know, geographic. I tend not to entertain this way, but if you're doing, say, a Spanish meal, you can have a bunch of different Spanish cheeses or a bunch of different French cheeses. Or you can go really sort of super thematic. One thing that I saw someone do once at Murray's when they were picking out cheese was they wanted all women cheesemongers.
Oh, I love
which
that.
Which is possible. There's actually a lot of amazing women making cheese in this country. And that's an entirely possible thing to do if you want to get a conversation started over your cheese plate. For me, I usually go the texture route. So something soft, something firm, maybe something washed rind, something blue.
And I've noticed lately that a lot of people seem to be doing the milks, a cow, a sheep,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a goat.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a buffalo.
Oh, yes, maybe a buffalo. Don't want to leave them out.
Yes, don't leave those guys out. And what's great is some of these bigger, more trafficked cheese stores will often have a little symbol, you know, on the tag of the animal. So you can build that plate yourself if you're not working with a cheesemonger. You know, one thing to do would be to have a cheese that has all three milks in it, and then the rest of the cheeses say all sheep. So then when you taste that other cheese that has all three milks, you can kind of try to pick up on where the sheep's milk flavor is coming from.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never done that.
It's a little palate training exercise.
So how many cheeses do you tend to do if it's not a huge party? Let's say you're having between 6 and 12 people. How many different cheeses would you put on your platter?
I'm a believer in odd numbers, so I would probably, with that many people, do 3 or 5 cheeses. Probably 3. I think having more of something looks better. People feel like you're skimping on them if you have a smaller amount of five cheeses versus a larger amount of three. And just to me, visually, odd numbers work better in every case of anything. And the basic rule in terms of amounts is I usually go for about 3 ounces per person if it's an appetizer portion.
That's another thing. You know, it's funny. I was talking recently with a friend about how strange it is in a way that we Americans love to do this huge cheese plate before we're going to sit down at a dinner that might have a lot of courses.
Yeah. And to me, I'm not a huge sweets person. So for me, the cheese plate is often the dessert or the last course. Same thing, same amount. But people do, they like to nibble on something while they're eating. I think it also has to do with alcohol consumption. you kind of do need to have something in your belly to soak up the wine if you're drinking a lot of wine before the meal.
So let's say your guests are coming for dinner at 7. When would you pull the cheese out of the refrigerator?
If I went and bought it that late morning, I would probably leave it out. If you notice at a cheese counter, the bank where they're keeping the cheese it's not that freezing cold as our refrigerator is. Cheese is almost always too cold for me. So I would take it out a couple hours before.
Okay, so now let's move on to like one of the most important parts, the medium. How do you get the cheese to your mouth? Do you opt for bread?
The vehicle.
Yes, the vehicle. Is it bread, crackers, or a fork?
Or your finger. I think the less is more. So I will often just serve cheese with like a barely toasted slice of baguette, thin slice. I'm also partial to those, we call them crackers, but they're really cookies, those Kars whole wheat. Do you know those whole wheat crackers?
Oh, yeah. Those are great.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I love those. And those are a nice accompaniment to some of the creamier cheeses. I guess the main rule is to stay away from something that's heavily flavored. There's a lot of crackers now that are like heavy cracked pepper or have rosemary in them. And that to me, it just kills the flavor of the cheese. My exception is the kind of fruity nut-based heavier like German style breads that are pretty dry and crackery are great with a blue cheese. That play between the veiny blue cheese and the sweet and nutty partial, but part of those kinds of breads, their accompaniment is just great.
Now, what about accompaniments? There are so many these days. You go to cheese counters and you're just bombarded with these little jars of so many titillating little things.
I know. Little condiments. They want you to buy all of those things. You know, there's some traditional accompaniments that make sense. You know, quince paste, for example, with some Spanish cheeses or hard cheeses is delicious. Honey can be great, especially if you're doing this as a dessert course. Some spicier mustards. But to me, the cheese, not to be cliche, but the cheese does stand alone. And I think that you can get lost in all of these, as you say, titillating little condiments. Caramelized onions are sometimes a really nice accompaniment on a cheese plate if they're cooked gently and slow and have a little bit of sweetness. But to me, overpowering a cheese with sugar is usually an unwanted distraction. With that exception, I love quince, like with a manchego. I think that's a pretty amazing experience.
This has been so great, and it's made me very hungry. Thank
me
you
too.
So much.
You're so welcome.
Sarah-Kate Gillingham-Ryan's new book is Good Food to Share, Recipes for Entertaining with Family and Friends. Sarah-Kate is, of course, the founder of Apartment Therapy's TheKitchen.com, which we really love here at Good Food. Coming up, I've got more cheesy conversation. We're talking pizza in 30 seconds here on 89.9 FM and KCRW.com.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
Welcome back to Good Food. Here with me now is Leslie Barger-Suter. She's the dine editor of Los Angeles Magazine and a frequent guest on the show. Today we're talking about several newish dining establishments on the West Side.
when you say you're going out to eat in Venice, you think Abbot Kinney, 10-2 these days. You don't think, on the boardwalk. In fact, some of the things you can get on the boardwalk are a little scary. A piercing with your hot dog. But here, right, you are right smack on the Strand. It is called Larry's. It's Brendan Collins is the chef. He's also still at Waterloo and City, which is sort of a British gastropubby type thing. Here he's at Larry's, which is a much more American, extremely California concept. It's all outside. I mean, wherever you can sit, it's all outdoors because it's on the beach and it's California. So you're right out on the water on this big deck. There's a roaring fireplace. There's a big bar that's got these sort of colorful tiles all over the bar. The bar itself has like 25 beers on tap. But the food, and this is what it keeps amazing me. So you're on the beach and you're looking at these people in leather and tattoos on stilts with the crazy, you know, the Venice Beach performers, if you will, that are walking by. And yet there you are, noshing on a barbecued eel and foie gras terrine with a muscat gelée, which to me, I can't tell what's more daring, the fashion choices that are walking by or the fact that Brendan is cooking this kind of food in that environment. It's
so not what you expect when you think of, quote, beach dining.
No, not at all. And I mean, he's known for his charcuterie. He does great charcuterie. So it's no surprise. He does that at Waterloo and City. So it's no surprise that he has those here. He also has a duck and pistachio pâté that's really lovely. He does some sandwiches. They do like a pork cheek BLT on rye that's really great. But it's also got a huge pizza menu. The pizzas themselves are they're not any classic anything, you know, as tends to be the vogue right now in LA. It's just, if it's a good pizza, it doesn't have to be Neapolitan or, you know, any specific thing.
It's just good.
Just, you know, caring about the dough, things like that. But the toppings are really neat. They do one, it's got green chorizo, chipotle, and then an egg.
Ooh.
Which is amazing. They got one that's Brussels sprouts, bacon, parmesan, and then a chili vinegar sort of on it. So they're really, but they also have the pepperoni, and they've got one with all sorts of pork parts on it and all of that. But the pizzas are great. It's a really unique vibe. We chose it in the magazine as the photograph this month purely for the fact that to show people actually eating, and then you can see somebody riding their bike by on the Strand in the background with the palm trees. So unique. On a nice sunny afternoon.
It's the perfect place to take out-of-town visitors.
Oh, yeah, because you do feel like you have to go take your out-of-town visitors to walk down Venice Beach to show it to them, but then you have to go drive 15 minutes inland to get them a bite to eat. No longer. Larry's is here for you.
Now, the next place we're going to go is just a little bit away in Santa Monica, and it's also pizza.
Yes, this place is Stella Rosa Pizza Bar. It's got it in the name. You know, this place has been open for 6 months. It's not a spring chicken in restaurant terms, but it's opened, it's run and organized by this corporation, Let Us Entertain You, which is a big, mega super corporation. They own M Street Kitchen, which is attached, and L2O, which is...
It's a huge Chicago, they started in the Chicago
yes,
area.
Yes, they started in Chicago, as our chef came from as well, but... So, you know, when you hear that, we kind of weren't sure, is it corporate pizza? I don't know. So I'll admit it, I lagged. I lagged on going. But I went, and I have been won over. I have been wooed. It's amazing. You walk in. It's sort of through M Street Kitchen. You kind of got to walk through it to get to the back. And when you get there, you see this big, bustling bar. We had to wait 20 minutes to get in. It's because the place is just packed. Big, bustling bar, and around it, some tables. And at the back, there's a big oven and these sort of glass shelves that have, looks like Frankenstein's lab in there, because they've got these glass jars in which are pre-portioned amounts of dough that are doing their finishing rise in these jars. And it's great because some are sort of lower and then some are at the top. And I talked to Jeff afterwards. I asked him about his pizza. He said that they figured out with these jars that when the dough just bubbles up just above the surface, that's when they know it's perfect and ready to go. So it's kind of a good guide to do that.
Tell me about his dough.
Pizza chefs love to talk about their dough. and he is no exception. But it's really interesting. You know, there's a lot of different types of flour people use for pizza. People drop names like Double Zero or Capunto, which are these flours that are, milled in Italy. And they are great. But Jeff actually went up with sort of a non-disclosed source and drove up the San Joaquin Valley up to this guy's secret wheat farm and mill where he created this custom blend that's totally top secret. He wouldn't even give me the name, even if I swore I'd never tell. And he's doing his custom milled flour that they worked out together. And if you've worked with regular pizza flour and you've seen it, it's so fine. This is a hearty grain, which is really surprising. You can see the sort of rough mill in the ball of dough. You can see little bits. bits of darker grain in there. It's more of a bread flour, really, than it is a pizza flour, but it makes for a really interesting pizza crust. But this is a family pizzeria. This is a comfortable place.
Okay. It's not pretentious.
It is not pretentious. Jeff talks a lot about nostalgia and how pizza for people in America especially is such a nostalgic food.
Absolutely. Why serve it if you're going to make it into some precious thing that a kid can't play with?
Well, and our version of nostalgia is not a traditional Neapolitan pizza in Naples. Our idea of pizza nostalgia a lot of times is like Chuck E. Cheese and, you know, a giant New York slice. Now, this is neither. This is wonderful, great sort of medium-sized, thin crust, but not super thin pizza. But they have, you know, they have the pepper flakes in shakers on the table. If you go kind of early enough and they're not too busy and you come with your kids, they've got a little area of the bar where you can slide up a stool. Their kid can, and they'll give them a thing of dough and let the kid make their own pizza, which just blows kids' minds.
Tell me one or two of the pizzas that you ate that you love. Tell
sure.
me about the toppings.
Well, the margarita, the classic, is great. They do a wonderful tomato sauce. The mozzarella they use is really nice. That's great. They've also got, I'm an anchovy person. I love them. So they
too.
Do white anchovies with Fresno chilies,
ooh,
which is really great. They've got a whole bunch of white pies that are yummy.
That means without tomato sauce.
Yes, that means without tomato sauce. But then they also do, you know, they've got fancy pies, but then they throw you a pepperoni. But then, and in terms of other plates, they had one thing that blew my mind is they do this burrata presentation, the mozzarella that's really gooey, and they serve it with a thing of grapes, and you pop a grape in your mouth and you say, "What is that?" It is smoky and a little greasy and meaty, and you said, "What does this come from?" It comes from the fact that the M Street Kitchen has a wood-fired oven, and they just thought, "Well, wouldn't it be cool if, or a wood-fired grill? Wouldn't it be cool if you just threw the grapes on the grill for a second and took them off?" And the grilled grapes are like a revelation with the burrata and a little bread, and you get the smokiness and the thing, all in the sweetness of the grape. That was a hit for me. I thought it was really, really clever and really smart.
Terrific! Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Leslie Barker Suter, Dine Editor of Los Angeles Magazine. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia and Candace Moyer are our segment producers. The executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and Carrie Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.